You know, I was, thank you for bringing your Bibles. If you would be turning to Ecclesiastes 5, some of you have commented about the fact that I had a little bit of a tan. I just want to tell you that my office window is allowing all that sunlight to come in. I had a good week. I missed you last week, but the first part of the week was really good because I got to go fishing and I caught lots of fish. And the second part, the latter part of the week was good because we had a really good gospel meeting. We had three baptisms and we had lots of other responses. In fact, folks are still contacting me about that positively, I might add. So we really had a good week. We miss being with you and we're glad that we're back. In Ecclesiastes 5, I like reading Ecclesiastes. For a long time, I didn't because there are some things in it that bothered me until I realized that you have to read Ecclesiastes as life on the earth. There are some statements made that can be taken out of context, much like there are in the book of Job, that you really have to set it in a context. And Ecclesiastes is written by the wise man. He says, calls himself the preacher. And it's bits of wisdom that have to do with life on this earth. And you have to keep that in mind as you read it. And you know, as I think about the stories in the Bible, and maybe particularly the ones in the New Testament that Jesus told, or as you think about them, is there any story that particularly bothers you? Any of them that really kind of get really close to you? Well, I have to tell you, there's one that Jesus tells the story. It is an incident, and he relates it of the young man who came to him and wanted to know what to do to inherit eternal life, and he ended up by telling him to go and sell what he had, give it to the poor, and come and follow him. I have to tell you, that story bothers me some. I don't know about you, but the Lord has financially blessed me more than I ever could have imagined. I don't mean that I'm rich by the standards of this world, but when you grow up on the farm hauling hay, making 50 cents an hour, then everything looks up from there. And working in a grocery store as a teenager in high school, I never could imagine that the Lord would bless me the way that he has blessed me and my family. And that also scares me some. And part of the reason is because I'm in a position to see what financial prosperity can do to folks. And it's not always good. There are lots of times, there are at least times when financial success pulls people away from the Lord. And when Jesus said it's hard for a rich man to go to heaven, Jesus always knew what he was talking about. And we tend to dismiss those kind of things as not applying to me. We agree with what Jesus said. We're certainly not going to disagree with what he said, but somehow it just doesn't apply to us very, very well. And so I thought it would be good. And I know when I first came here, some folks reminded me kind of humorously that I evidently preached a good number of sermons on materialism. And But I think we need to talk about this fairly regularly because we live in a society that is so very materialistic. And I believe we need to constantly be reminded and taught how to keep our material possessions under our control rather than being controlled by them. Because I think it's so subtle and it happens so easily and smoothly that it happens without us realizing it. That we become a lot more concerned about material things and possessions than we do about spiritual things sometimes. I've noticed an interesting thing under the sun, to borrow Solomon's phrase, and I didn't know it for a long time in my life, that those who are rich tend to be prejudiced against those who are poor. And I think I at least thought that I knew that much of my life, but to flip the coin over, I didn't know the other side of it. So do those who are poor tend to be prejudiced against those who are rich. And I didn't know that for a long time in my life, but it can be as much one way as it is the other. We can take great, have as a source of pride, a lifestyle that is kind of poor. And we can nearly have a sense of pride about living that way. And we can look at people who live in a different way and we can feel a pride about ourselves. And I think that can be just as devastating as it can to flip the coin over. The question that comes to my mind is money a blessing or a curse? And maybe our answer is kind of like the character on the Fiddler on the Roof, the father. He said money is, or having been told that money is the world's curse, then he said, may the Lord smite me with it and may I never recover. And I really think that maybe, you know, we probably wouldn't be so bold as to say that, but we kind of feel that about material things and money. Perhaps Satan's most consistently powerful deceit is to persuade us that money will solve our problems. And let's be clear about it, we'll solve some problems, won't it? When we address the topic of money, God chooses a really rich man to teach us some lessons, and that's Solomon. And I guess because he's been there, done that. And if you're going to believe the advice of anybody, it's going to probably be somebody who knows what he's talking about, someone who has experienced it, and he can give us some advice about his experience. If it's someone that has never experienced it, then we would probably have, with some good reason, to doubt whether or not we should follow their advice. But when Solomon speaks, if he speaks about money, he probably knows something whereof he speaks, doesn't he? In Ecclesiastes chapter 5, we're going to be looking at verse 7 through 10, and we're going to listen to Solomon tell us why money doesn't solve all problems. The preacher has told us not to be surprised at the oppression of the poor. In chapter 5, verse 8, he said, if you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, do not be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are still others higher still. The increase on the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. And so that's what happens when greedy men rule over each other. It's just the money filters up. But if oppression of the poor is inevitable and unavoidable in under the sun, then our minds naturally turn to the solution to that. And the solution would obviously seem to be, well, if the poor are oppressed, then they need to get rich. So the preacher takes this opportunity to say that there's no help, no real help, and riches either. And he's already talked about the futility of riches in chapter 2, and I want to read several verses there to get this in our mind. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure and find out what is good. But that also proved to be meaningless. Laughter, I said, is foolish. And what does pleasure accomplish? I tried cheering myself with wine, embracing folly, but my mind still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for men to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. I undertook great projects. I built houses for myself. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks and planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made reservoirs to water groves of flourishing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had other slaves who were born in my house. I also owned more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before me. I amassed silver and gold for myself and treasure of kings and provinces. I acquired men and women singers and a harem as well. The delights of the heart of man, I became greater by far than anyone in Jerusalem before me. In all this, my wisdom stayed with me. I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labor. When I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless, a chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun. And you know, we might feel about this like the fiddler did, or the guy speaking who said, "May the Lord smite me with it and may I never recover." You know, I want my chance to find that out for myself. Well, it would really be sad, and you know, it's really ironic that the wisest man who's ever lived had real difficulty at the end of his life. In fact, he left the Lord at the end of his life, didn't he? And it must have had a lot to do with all of these things that he had. He has complained specifically that he has to leave everything that he's labored for to a man who will come after him, and he doesn't know whether he'll be a fool or whether he won't be. And if you stop and look at what happened to him in his life, his son didn't do very well, did he, with what he inherited. He's reflected, on the other hand, of the great futility of having no one to leave his riches to, in chapter 4, verse 8. But perhaps there's some value in them after all, not to leave as an inheritance necessarily, but to be enjoyed and to be used properly in this life under the sun, he'll say. And so I want to look at chapter 5, beginning in verse 10, and see five reasons that he gives us why money doesn't solve all problems. Number one, in verse 10, he says, "Whoever loves money never has enough money. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless." Have you not found that in your life? Maybe you have a probably much more limited view than he did, but haven't you found that to be true in your own life? You thought, well, if I can just get this next raise, then everything's going to really be good. And so it happens that you get it. And then you're happy for a little while. And then you start thinking about the next raise. And maybe you get it, and you're happy for a little while. And there's no end to it, is it? It's like the man who, he says, all he wants is the land that joins his, that little piece of land that joins his. That's all he wants. Well, there's no end to that, is it? And so he says, there's not enough money in the world to satisfy a person whose desire is money. Tennis star Boris Becker, who's a German tennis player who turned pro at age 17, was at the top of the tennis world, yet he was on the brink of suicide. He was interviewed and he said, "I had won Wimbledon twice before, once as the youngest player in history. I was rich. I had all the material possessions I needed." It's the old song of movie stars and pop stars who commit suicide. They have everything, and yet they're so unhappy. "I had no inner peace. I was a puppet on a string." And Jack Higgins, the author of such successful novels as The Eagle Has Landed, was asked what he would like to have known as a boy that would have changed his life. And he said, "I would have liked to have known that when you get to the top, there's nothing there." That's a hard thing to find out after you've spent your life to get to the top, isn't it? Born into a small, cramped house with lots of people, professional basketball player Scottie Pippen didn't have very much as a boy, but his journey into the NBA changed all that. From 1999 through 2002, his contract delivered $14.7 million a year. not to mention the income from endorsements. He already owned a 74-foot yacht and a $100,000 Mercedes, but that doesn't shield anyone from the negative effects of comparing ourselves to others. A Sports Illustrated feature said, "Before every game in Portland's Rose Garden, Pippen let his gaze drift over to the courtside seat occupied by Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft and owner of both the Trailblazers and the Seattle Seahawks, a man with a personal net worth of $40 billion-plus. That's with a B. What does he have?" Pippen asked. $40 billion. How can I make just $1 billion? I want just one of them. What do I need to do?" And so one of the things that Solomon is trying to tell us is that for a person who has a desire, a craving for money, there's never enough. There is no place at which you can say, that's it. That's good enough. I mean, if you were making $14.7 million a year, would you be happy? Probably not. Probably not. Not if that was what you were living for. And then a second thing that Solomon tells us in verse 11 and 12, "As goods increase, so do those who consume them. And what benefit are they to the owner except to feast his eyes on them? The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep." I can remember as a young man riding with a rancher one time who owned several thousand acres of land and several thousand head of cattle. And he wanted to take me out to look at his place. And so we went out and looked at it. And as we looked at the cattle and went from one place to another, then he said, "Well, what do you think?" And I said, "Well, you really have a beautiful place. And, you know, it looks like you've really done well." And he said, "You know what? What you just said is all there is in it. There's nothing else. The fact that you say it's a beautiful place and it looks like you've done well," he said, "there's nothing else in it. That's all there is." That really struck me as strange. But I think I understand that a little bit better. He knew he wasn't taking any of it with him. He knew there wasn't anything that it did for him because he was far, far beyond meeting any needs that he or his family might have had. And so Solomon tells us that it attracts a larger circle of dependents and it results in sleepless nights. "The sleep of a laborer is sweet, whether he eats little or much, but the abundance of a rich man permits him no sleep." In an interview with Rolling Stone magazine, celebrity Brad Pitt reflected on his lead role in the movie Fight Club, which is about a man who had the American dream and yet he remained unsatisfied. And in the interview, Pitt said, "Man, I know all these things are supposed to seem important to us, the car, the condo, our version of success, but if that's the case, why is the general feeling out there reflecting more impotence and isolation and desperation and loneliness? If you ask me, I say, toss all this. We got to find something else. Because all I know is that at this point in time, we're headed for a dead end, a numbing of the soul, a complete atrophy of the spiritual being, and I don't want that." And the interviewer said, "So if we're heading toward this kind of existential end in society, what do you think should happen?" And Pitt said, "Hey, man, I don't know those answers yet. The emphasis now is on success and personal gain." And he stopped and smiled. "I'm sitting on it, and I'm telling you that's not it. I'm the guy who's got everything. I know. But I'm telling you, once you've got everything, then you're just left with yourself. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. It doesn't help you to sleep any better and you don't wake up any better because of it." And then Solomon also told us in verse 13, warned us, "I've seen a grievous evil under the sun, wealth hoarded to the harm of its owner." March 1988, Rotarian, and I know that goes way back, but it stuck with me and I saved it. tells about a bounty of $5,000 offered for each wolf that was captured alive. And it turned Sam and Jed into fortune hunters. Day and night, they scoured the mountains and forests looking for their valuable prey. Exhausted one night, they fell asleep dreaming of their potential fortune. And suddenly Sam awoke to see that they were surrounded by about 50 wolves with flaming eyes and bared teeth. He nudged his friend and said, "Jed, wake up. We're rich." Somehow wealth distorts your sense of reality, doesn't it? And it makes it hard to trust God. And the reason that it does is because everything that God offers, Satan offers a counterfeit. And most of it you can buy with money. Now you need to let that sink in. Security that God offers, Satan offers a counterfeit. And you can buy it with money. And you can just start listing the things that are important to us that God offers. And every single one of them, Satan has a counterfeit. And he gives you a shortcut, a short way to get it. But the problem is, it's not the real thing. And it doesn't last. You remember our study about faith, and we went to the book of Hebrews, and we talked about the statement, without faith, it's impossible to please God. And then it tells you why. Because they that come to him must believe that he exists, and he rewards those who diligently seek him. And the real secret, I believe, to that verse lies in the one statement in that that we overlook. That is, they that come to him. Because I believe that money offers you the opportunity to get what you think God offers without coming to him. You can go somewhere else and get what God offers. And you can get it a lot easier, and it's a lot more fun. He's had a long time to practice, and he's gotten good, hadn't he? He's always been good. He was good in the garden, wasn't he? What was it that God offered in the garden that Eve decided, hey, I can have that, and all I have to do is just this, and I can have it. And everything that Satan tells you and everything that he offers is a lie. But he's made it possible so that it feels good all the way to the very end. Most of the time. Or some of the time. It gets kind of bitter sometimes, doesn't it? Even in this life. I mean, there's an aftertaste, isn't there? And it really, really can get bitter in life whenever you have worked all your life for retirement and you've got enough money in the bank that you now can live. You know, if you live to be 120 years old, you got enough money to take you there unless some catastrophe happens and then you retire. And are you happy? It's what you've worked for your whole life. And are you happy? And I'm not saying that there are no people who are happy who are retired, but it brings its own problems also, doesn't it? It brings its own difficulties. And then in verse 14, he gives us a fourth reason. He says, our wealth lost through some misfortune, so that when he has a son, there is nothing left for him. Most of us have felt a little touch of that in the last few years, haven't we? If you were invested in the stock market at all, maybe your IRA or your 501, your 401k took about a 40% hit here not too long ago, didn't it? Lots of folks. And some of us are not quite back to where we were, you know, back at that point. It can happen. It has happened in this country. The people who are wealthy overnight lost everything. It's happened en masse, hasn't it? And it can happen again. And when that's what you put your trust in, when that's your security and it's gone, what do you have to live for? And so people committed suicide. Mike Tyson earned, in the 9 years before he filed bankruptcy in August 2003, he earned somewhere between $300 and $500 million. in the 9 years before he declared bankruptcy. It can happen. It does happen. And that story is very common, isn't it? People who come into riches, maybe they win a lottery, then is their life get better because of that? Very, very rarely, doesn't it? And so it can be lost suddenly. And then the last one in verse 15 and 16, he says, a man comes naked from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. He takes nothing from his labor that he can carry in his hand. This too is a grievous evil. As a man comes, so he departs. And what does he gain, since he toils for the wind? What we work to earn in this life, in material possessions, you can't take it with you. And there's all kind of lines that we've come up with about there's no trailers behind hearses and so forth, and there's not any way that you can take any of it with you. For his first sermon in elementary preaching class, Lawrence, an African student, chose a text describing the joys that we'll share when Christ returns and he ushers us to our heavenly home. And he said, I've been in the United States for several months now. I've seen the great wealth that's here, the fine homes, the cars and clothes. I've listened to many sermons in churches here also, but I've yet to hear one sermon about heaven. Because everybody has so much in this country, no one preaches about heaven. People here don't seem to need it. In my country, most people have very little, so we preach on heaven all the time. We know how much we need it. You know Solomon's conclusion. Let us hear the conclusion of the matter, he said. Fear God, keep his commandments. This is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every work into judgment and every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. And I thought, in fact, I want to preach a lesson soon about the dangers that are involved in your computer. I thought, how many of us today would like for God to take our computer and all the hits that we've made in the last 6 months and put them up for the whole world to see? Might be kind of revealing, wouldn't it? And you might think about that, because he says every secret thing is going to be brought to light. It's going to have a bright light shined on it. Everybody is going to see. But the one that really matters is God, and he already sees. He already knows. I'm not going to tell you that money is good for nothing. It is good for something. And God does not condemn you because you have money. In fact, if you have money, it's because God has blessed you with it, isn't it? Abraham was a rich man. Job was a rich man, and God restored double his riches back to him. And so it's not a sin to be rich. It's not a sin to have things. But it is deceitful. And it promises a lot more than it can deliver. And it doesn't solve all problems. It cannot give a true sense of security. And so our question is, will we listen to money and what it promises? Or will we listen to God and follow his path? And will we use the things that God has given to us for his glory and to further his kingdom? And to bless others rather than to simply satisfy and even create our own desires. So I ask you to think about these things in your life, and I'll think about them myself. I have been, as I've been reminded by this sermon, that it's so easy to listen to the lie that the devil has. And he pays pretty good wages sometimes, doesn't he? We can see that sometimes evil men prosper, don't they? Sometimes his pay is really, really good. And so in all of this, there are times when we can't know if what the source of all of this is, this opportunity. Maybe Satan put it in front of us, maybe God. The only thing that we can know is, let's listen to what God tells us, and let's follow his commands, and let's use everything, every opportunity, every blessing that he's given us. Let's always use it for the very highest and best way that we possibly can. And that way we can really have the security that God offers. If you need to come, won't you come while we stand and sing?